Hi, I'm Joel Richenberger, sports editor for the Steamboat Pilot and Today newspaper in Steamboat Springs. Every so often, I'm reminded that I have one of the best jobs in Steamboat Springs. I was in a downtown Steamboat coffee shop in February talking with Kim Hess, ahead of her departure for the trip she's currently on, to Nepal to climb Mount Everest. That was one of those days for me. Kim was on Mount Everest last year, high on the mountain as a devastating earthquake struck. Hearing stories like hers is one of the most interesting parts of my job. We talked for more than an hour, and I found every second fascinating. Afterward, I couldn't shake the feeling. I think other people would like to listen too. So I want to start a podcast. I want to record interviews with the interesting people in Steamboat Springs and the interesting things they do in the sports and outdoors world. And I want to share that with our readers and anyone else interested. I stumbled across too many awesome stories to not follow through on this. So this is what I hope is the first of many, my first podcast. Some of the details about the when, who, and how of this podcast are still up in the air at this point, but I'll have them straightened out as soon as I can. Despite that, I wanted to start. I wanted to start with this conversation with Kim in the coffee shop, even though it's not the best audio and there's plenty going on in the background. I'm sorry. The story is more than Kim, however. This podcast coincides with a feature story that was printed in Sunday's Steamboat Pilot and Today newspaper. They're both a bit different. For each, though, I interviewed other climbers who have experience on Mount Everest and who were in the region at the time of the earthquake. This is the story I put together, one about an earthquake, danger, and why people are willing to risk so much just to climb the world's tallest mountain. In my reporting this story about the earthquake at Mount Everest and in Nepal last year, I've been able to talk to four people, all from Steamboat Springs, who were in the region at the time of the quake last year. And one of the things that jumps out right away is the fact that none of them really knew what was happening once it started happening. Maybe that's true of all earthquakes, and or very least for people who have never experienced them before. None of the people I talked to had experienced one before. Steamboat Springs residents Tim and Janet Borden were vacationing in the region and didn't at first know why their hotel room had suddenly started shaking. Searing Dorje Sherpa was on the slopes of a nearby mountain about 20 miles from Mount Everest, and he didn't know either. Kim Hess certainly didn't know.
You take me through that day a little bit?
Yeah, so I climbed with International Mountain Guides out of Ashford, Washington, and I was on what's called the hybrid team. So there were five of us, and actually there were only four of us at this point. We had lost one member. He was just a day behind us. But we were doing our first rotation, is what they call it. So from base camp, we went up to camp one, and we were supposed to sleep for two nights there, and then move up to camp two, sleep for two nights, and then go all the way back down to base camp and just hang out for a couple days and rest.
Yeah.
So we had done our two nights at camp one, and we woke up that morning, and packed up and started moving to camp two. Yeah, we rolled into camp two just before noon, 11:30, and it was a very snowy day. The clouds were super low. You couldn't see anything around you. Had no real idea what camp two had looked like. Obviously, I'd seen pictures and I'd studied maps, but can't see anything, so I didn't really know my surroundings that well. And we all kind of picked a tent and went to change into our big down suits, and I was sitting in my tent with my tent mate, and the ground just started violently shaking, and I just thought, holy shit, our tent is going to implode into this glacier that we're sleeping on. That was my thought. So I jump out of the tent, no shoes, just in my long underwear, and start looking around. And
barefoot.
Oh, okay. And I see, you know, I pop out and I see our guide Andy, and his face just kind of said it all. And you could just hear just a rumble and kind of this amphitheater that we were sitting in. And the ground stopped shaking, but the noise was just somewhat terrifying because you didn't know where it was coming from. So now we knew that there were avalanches, but we couldn't see anything.
I covered that part of her story pretty thoroughly in Sunday's newspaper story, and we'll definitely cover it here too. But I wanted to start with something else, something that kind of adds a theme to this production. Unseen avalanches all over the place? That sounds horrible. When I talk to Kim or anyone else who's done something similar, I can't help but wonder, why? Why was she there? Okay, maybe last year was one thing, but she went back. The disasters are some of the most interesting parts of these big mountain climbing stories, of course. They're the stories people read, and I'm certainly not immune to writing them. I've probably written a dozen stories about various Steamboat Springs climbers tackling the Himalayan mountains over the years, and I'm sure they've all, in some way, revolved around that risk, around life and death. John Krakauer wrote one of the best, if not the most definitive, Everest disaster books, Into Thin Air. Every mountaineer I've ever talked to has read it. But they're all still mountaineers. They all still go. The book is about expert climbers, at least a few expert climbers, who die high on Mount Everest. Yet it does nothing to dissuade more expert climbers from going to the region and following in their footsteps. What's up with that?
Certainly reading that or reading like stories of disasters didn't set me off, make me not want to go there. I mean, maybe to some degree it has a little bit of the opposite effect of making it seem like adventure and risk and danger and all those types of things.
That's Doug Tumanello, and I asked him about this question. Doug is a Steamboat Springs-based lawyer who's ticked off an incredible series of adventures over the years. This spring, he's just back from a December and January attempt to cross-country ski to the South Pole. In the past, he's joined a team to row across the Indian Ocean, and he's participated in adventure races. In 2006, he climbed Mount Everest.
So that was actually the 10th anniversary of the Into Thin Air climb that we all know about. So I was there for the 10th anniversary of that. Not that that's particularly meaningful, but you know, that disaster, the 96 disaster, changed the way a lot of things happen on Everest, which even flows through to today, even though those changes didn't sort of presage any of the stuff that happened last year with the big avalanche and earthquakes and avalanche and all that. It had not been a goal for me, and I was almost a happenstance leader of an expedition to Everest. My goal had been to climb an 8,000 meter peak over there, none that I had identified specifically, but not Everest. And so, as I started that process, I met a guy who was organizing an Everest expedition, and so. So I became effectively a teammate or a member of that team. Well, that ended up falling apart, as so often happens, and he stepped away. But by that point, I was so invested in the project, if you will, that I became the de facto team leader and organized the expedition. And so next thing you know, I found myself, and all this played out over a couple of years, basically, which isn't unusual. But then next thing you know, I found myself in Nepal as the team leader of an Everest expedition.
And you've never even been to the region.
This is my first time in the Himalayas.
You said you'd wanted to climb an 8,000 meter peak. Why did you have the interest in the first place?
So mountaineering is my background. And I've done a lot of mountaineering throughout North America and South America. I had never been to the Himalayas, but that's sort of a destination if you're consider yourself a mountaineer. Going over to the Himalayas is always sort of this far off goal and dream, or at least it was for me, having read the story since I was a kid about climbing the big peaks. So testing myself on an 8,000 meter peak, I thought was really a worthy goal, something that I wanted to try.
You wanted to go over there, but not necessarily to Everest. Why not?
Well, Everest has such a mixed reputation. It is Everest. It's the tallest mountain, and it has the allure for that, and it has the history behind it, so that makes it very attractive. On the other hand, it's a very crowded mountain. It's a very busy mountain. By no means is it a wilderness climbing experience. Yeah. It's the exact opposite of that. You're always with lots of people. So that's sort of the downside to it. In my mind, though, the positives outweighed the downsides. When I went over there, I knew I wasn't going into a wilderness climbing experience where we'd be off and on our own, but we'd be in with you know, the throngs of other people who are on the mountain. Yeah. And frankly, it's in many ways, it's nice to be in base camp with teams from all over the world, to meet those people and to speak yeah. with them and to see different people from different cultures and all that. There's some attractiveness to that. But that hadn't been my original goal, but that's yeah. okay.
Doug wanted to go, but back to that first question. People die climbing Mount Everest. People who don't think it will happen to them.
Just getting into the mountains is something, or getting into the Himalayas is something that I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, though, you saw the movie Everest, and it, I think it sort of over-dramatized things a bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the reality is that while big disasters do happen and unforeseen disasters can happen, usually the way that disaster or death occurs in the mountains is a sort of an aggregation of small mistakes, which add up. Mm-hmm. And it's not paying attention to those small issues as they arise or making bad judgment calls when conditions change. Those things tend to build on themselves, and then there's a final straw, which then creates the disaster. So, you know, in my mind, going over there and climbing those mountains means, you know, keeping a check on those small things mm-hmm. and recognizing when they come up and then addressing them or turning around as the case may be, so that the big disaster doesn't occur. So, you know, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but I tend to think that generally a big disaster, though it can happen, generally is not going to, yeah. if you're paying attention to real the basic details and the basic sort of blocking and tackling. But, you know, I mean, obviously we had, you know, last year with the earthquakes and the avalanche yeah. were unforeseen in many ways and, you know, caused the death and destruction that they did.
Doug walks the walk when it comes to expedition safety. His South Pole trip is the perfect example. He spent years planning it and had to push it back several times before he finally left last November. He spent the holiday season away from his family in Antarctica, cross-country skiing by himself in conditions that sounded straight up miserable. It was cold, it was often windy, there was whiteout conditions much of the time, and his skiing was much slower than he'd hoped it would be. Before he left, he told me about how he hopes the trip will only be his first to Antarctica, that by proving he could ski to the South Pole, he'd be confident enough to attempt other bigger trips. Quitting early, while still generally healthy, could not have been easy, but that's exactly what he did. He'd been dealing with reoccurring problems with one of his skis, and that led to some reoccurring problems with one of his feet. He had a few other equipment problems as well, but he really could have kept going. Still, 36 days in, he decided to quit, because he didn't let the little things pile up. He called for help, and soon a plane was on the way to pick him up, and he was headed back towards civilization. Kim also came to Mount Everest with plenty of adventure experience. She's 31 years old and has been living in Steamboat Springs for 7 years. She grew up in Denver. She got her bachelor's degree from the University of Colorado, but wasn't ready to enter the workforce upon graduation.
What kind of places did you travel after college?
All over.
And?
I hit every continent except Antarctica.
Wow.
So, I was based out of Sydney, Australia. That's kind of where I moved and had a apartment and
oh, really?
Left stuff and had a job and then would just travel.
Travel for work at all or was it all, no?
I would just, I got a bartending job, first bartending job ever, and would work really hard for, you know, 2 months and then travel for 5 and come back and work a couple more months and take off again.
Give me some financial advice here. How do you work for 2 months and travel, enough to travel for 5?
Sydney, they pay you a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Because of the cost of living there. I think bartending, it was like Monday to Friday, you got $18 an hour. Saturdays, you got $20. And Sundays, you got $22 an hour on top of tips. And obviously, they don't tip 15%, like 15 or 20% like we do here.
Yeah.
So like 10%. But I was an American girl, and they thought I had a great accent, so I tend to do really well. I lived in a 3-bedroom house with 7 people, and, you know,
oh,
I was 22 years old. And
3-bedroom house with 7 people?
Oh, yeah. And then the next apartment I lived in, 3 of us shared a bed. I didn't really care where I slept. I just wanted to save every ounce of money I made so I could go travel.
Wow.
Yeah.
When her brother came up with the idea for more adventures to climb the seven summits, it wasn't a huge stretch for Kim to get on board.
For a lot of people, that'd be it. That'd have been like, you know, I wanted to do some adventures after college.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a heck of a story to tell,
yeah,
you know, around the dinner table 30 years later.
Yeah.
But that, obviously, that
I decided wasn't to quite enough. Ante.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my brother just suggested it, and I thought, well, I could keep traveling. I'm not done yet. And
yeah.
Wasn't ready to sit down and get a real job, whatever that means. So we just kind of kept the adventure alive. And now I think it's just turned into so much more. I haven't picked the most conventional lifestyle, but
yeah.
I keep telling my parents, any day now, it's going to pay off. They just need to trust me.
The seven summits consist of the tallest mountain on each continent around the world. Some of them you've certainly heard of, like Denali in Alaska, North America's tallest, or Kilimanjaro, the tallest mountain in Africa. Others wouldn't be particularly significant for the average mountain climber if they were not the tallest mountain on their landmass. They're certainly not the seven best mountains to climb in the world, and they're not the seven hardest or the seven easiest, but they're a goal a lot of people set out to accomplish climbing. Kim and her brother Steven are well on their way.
So after Everest, we still have Antarctica.
Yeah.
And then Australia.
An easy and a hard? Or are they both
pretty
hard?
Easy.
Both pretty easy?
They're both easy. Antarctica is just expensive.
Yeah. It's getting almost, to Antarctica.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost as expensive as Everest now.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a bummer.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Just you got to pace? Do you have a permit or something? The same way?
The permit's not that much. It's, I think, 3/4 of the cost goes to flying to Union Glacier. Yeah.
Hey, great news. I know a guy who knows a thing or two about flying to Alaska for an adventure. It's Doug, the guy we've just been talking about. Pay attention, please.
Run me through the other ones you've summed. So, Denali?
Yeah, so Denali.
Can you give me a one sentence or one paragraph comment on climbing Denali?
Expensive.
It's probably true for all of them.
Well,
right?
No, it wasn't supposed to be expensive.
Oh,
it was one of the greatest trips I signed up for until I broke my arm on the way down. So that
how did that happen?
Took a bad step and kind of snow broke into a crevasse and my arm was stuck in that fixed line rope and just snapped that puppy.
Does it hurt as much as it sounds like it did?
You know, the human body is a beautiful thing. Shock is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it didn't hurt that bad until I actually got to a doctor, you know, 5 days later. It wouldn't hurt bad.
Jesus, 5 days later? How much hiking was between you and
I hiked down maybe another hour to the largest established camp outside of their base camp, and then waited almost 2 days and got airlifted. And then from there, it was another day until I got to Anchorage, and then I finally saw a hand specialist and got some pain pills, and then I was on a red eye back to Denver and had surgery, I think, 6 days after I broke it.
So you sat there in that camp for 2 days? What do you do for 2 days with a broken arm?
Curse.
Read a book?
Yeah. I mean, just curse everything.
You knew it was broken, or you...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It, hand facing the wrong direction, bones, yeah. There was not a doubt in my mind. It was very broken.
What's it like at the summit of Denali?
You know, we didn't spend a whole lot of time up there. It was quick.
Yeah.
It was really cold. It was beautiful. I think the greatest part about our summit day was coming back down to our high camp, and we rolled into camp around midnight. And everybody kind of crawled into their tents, and I stayed outside because there was a full moon on one side, and then the sun was setting on the other. And it was just like, I just was back and forth. Where do I look?
Yeah.
This is the greatest thing I'll ever see. Elbrus, yep, so that, that's in Russia. We did that in 2012.
What's that, what's it like, the summit there?
It was windy.
Yeah?
It was so windy, I thought I was going to get blown off the top. It was fun, and that mountain kind of underestimated it, because it's essentially one big push, and it was a lot tougher than I thought it'd be. It's just a weird mountain, so you kind of, you're in this, it's a ski area, so you take a chairlift.
Oh, really?
like halfway up.
Oh, perfect. Yes. My kind of climbing.
Right? Perfect. Take a chairlift, and then you hike up a little bit, and you camp in these little hut things. And then essentially you wait for your weather window, and it's a large push to the summit and all the way back down. I want to say it was like 7,000 feet. I'm not positive, though.
Particularly challenging climb? Or?
No, just brutal. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was cold. It was windy.
Like, on the scale of between hike and climb, 10 being like climbing up a sheer rock wall.
Yeah, this is just a hike.
It is? Okay.
I mean, you're definitely, there's some steep sections where you're definitely roped together. And,
yeah.
You always have your ice axe out on the off chance that you fall. But no, it's just a brutal hike.
Kilimanjaro was a little more of a hike than that?
Kilimanjaro is definitely just a hike. We did that in 2012 as well. It's a good one. Kilimanjaro is great. I mean, you start in the jungle and you end on a glacier.
Yeah.
So it's like nothing you could ever imagine. And I believe it's the tallest freestanding mountain in the world.
Huh.
So it's just, it's cool. It's a cool culture.
Yeah. Am I missing one? I think I...
Aconcagua down in... Argentina.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yes, that was
that's a tough one.
That was the first one we ever did, yeah. It's the highest mountain outside of the Himalayas, so that was kind of a good place to start and see if we have it in us.
Yeah. What's it like, the summer there?
It was exhilarating. It was kind of a rough summit day. I found a dead person who had passed away the day before. It's definitely a mountain that people underestimate. They think it's just this glorified hike, when in fact it's a lot of work, and
yeah,
it's easy.
On the scale, closer to more climb than hike?
No, I mean, no.
No?
It's still hiking, but it's tough.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's in the Lonely Planet book is something to do when you're in Argentina.
Oh, yeah?
Which, I should write Lonely Planet and say, this is not something to just do. This is something that you have to... train for it and know what you're doing to do.
Did you see dead by probably at the base?
I just saw one on our summit day, and I guess four people had passed away the day before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Storm come in or something?
Yeah, they tried to summit about 12 hours before we did and got caught in a storm.
Four dead on a mountain the guidebooks may recommend as a nice place to take a hike. Ugh. Here we are, back at things going horribly wrong on mountains. One person who knows plenty about the topic is Searing Dorje Sherpa, one of the other Steamboat Springs residents who happened to be in the region at the time of last year's earthquake. Few are more experienced on mountains than Searing. He might be an easy guy to overlook if you didn't know who he was. Since moving to Steamboat Springs in 2012, he's been working very hard on his English, taking classes with his wife Dawa, but he's still at times a little hard to understand. He doesn't look like an athletic rock star either. He's short and stocky. His attitude doesn't even scream athlete. He's one of the happiest people I've ever met. Every time I call him, he answers the phone as if it's the best thing that happened to him that week. While I'm sure I'm a delight, I know it's not just me. He greets everyone and everything with that same attitude. He's so nice, so genuinely thoughtful sometimes, he just makes you want to go out and do something nice for someone else, to pay it forward. I love to tell the story of his most well-known day on a mountain, not because the grisly details are interesting, though, like it or not, they are. But because it's a perfect example of what I talked about at the top of this production, that this town is full of amazing people, and here's one who, if you passed him in the grocery store, you'd never expect, yet he's one of the most amazing. It was 2008, and he was climbing down from the summit of K2, the second tallest mountain in the world. K2, in Pakistan, isn't like Everest, with its hundreds of paying climbers and large expeditions. It's a mountain for the elite, climbed mostly by the elite. Searing made the trip with, among others, Steamboat Springs-based Dr. Eric Meyer. But Meyer and several other team members had been made nervous that morning by the slow pace and a warm day. The route goes through several extremely dangerous avalanche-prone areas, and Meyer decided not to push his luck. Searing was at the front of the pack, however, and made the summit. Things got nasty on the way down. Avalanches tore down the mountain and wiped out many of the fixed ropes climbers had intended to use to return to their high camp. Searing came upon the mess, and he found a fellow Sherpa stranded without those ropes and without his ice axe. He insisted Searing just continue on, but Searing didn't. He tied his countryman to a rope, then began climbing down an icy cliff, the other Sherpa dangling below him. All he had was his own ice axe, and all the way down, icy boulders flew past them. They finally made it down, and they were able to make it to camp. The heroic gesture earned Searing plenty of acclaim in the mountain climbing world. He told me it was one of the few times he's ever been scared on a mountain. Another was last April. He was climbing Choi Yu, another 8,000-meter peak near Everest. It's the sixth tallest mountain in the world. Searing likes to guide some clients up Choi Yu before taking them over to Everest. It's a great way to acclimatize, and sometimes clients are up for the chance to get two summits. That's where he was when the earthquake struck.
Wait, take me back to last year to the earthquake. Could you feel it where you were at?
Yeah, that is I did afternoon 12 o'clock, and I did like a lunch, and I take the Kobe and my friend, the Swedish Robin Zurich, and me. We drink the coffee and in the dining, and that's like whole body is shaking, and I said, what is this? And there's we have some kijabai that looks very bad, earthquake, and we are very scary. We are the Arbas base camp in the Choyu, and so scary. And then 1 minute after, they're coming whole in the mountain. Everywhere is coming big avalanche. Yeah.
How high were you?
5,500 meters.
Wow. And was that base camp there?
That's ABC, we call it.
Oh, okay.
Arbas base camp. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, ABC, yeah.
Had you already been higher up the mountain there?
That time we had planned the next day, we had to plan to go to Camp 1.
And there are avalanches coming down all around?
Everywhere. There we are the middle, but we are not having anything, say, in China's eyes, it's much safer. Nobody have any accident.
Were you close? I mean, would...
Yeah, we are like 200 meter.
Yeah.
In the avalanche. But,
wow.
Yeah.
He ended up spending much of the next year trying to help his nation rebuild. In the weeks after the quake, he chartered a helicopter in Kathmandu and had supplies flown to his home village, where many of the houses were destroyed.
So you get to your village, and what's your village look like when you first get there?
I go there, it's very sad. They're like a big way back coming, big avalanche, the rock avalanche. They're all destroyed, and it looks house, every house is damaged. And just go there inside where the village is very sad things, yeah.
Does your father still live there?
Yeah, my father at that time is in Kathmandu, and
he was.
Okay. Right now he's again back in the place. Yeah.
Yeah. Was anyone injured in your village?
One girl, she have little bit injured, little bit.
Oh, okay.
But mostly everybody okay. They're safe. They went earthquake. Everybody out from home.
No one was in their homes, huh?
No. If like afternoon, yeah. They're very lucky. And like evening happened, and a lot of people died. Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
He also had to have serious work done to a home he owns in Kathmandu. Now he's back in the region again this year, once again planning to climb Choi Yu, then head over to Mount Everest. If he reaches the Everest summit this season, it would be for the 13th time. Like I said, the guy's incredible. Back to Everest. Doug wasn't in the Himalaya last year, but when he was there, in 2006, he had his own brushes with disaster. The most jarring came early in the trip.
It was an unusually snowy early season.
Yeah.
So I think there was a lot of snow loading on the ice and the ice fall. And you know what the ice fall looks like.
Yeah.
You're generally familiar with that. And so there was a group of 10 Sherpas from a variety of teams,
yeah,
who were carrying a load up from base camp to Camp 1, which means you have to go up through the Khumbu Icefall. And there was just a serac collapse, a serac being one of those big ice,
yeah,
cliffs that you see in the pictures. And it buried 10 of them and killed 3 of those. And so it was, I mean, you always expect that there's a possibility of something going wrong like that on an expedition, although you'd never truly think, boy, this could happen to you or to your teammates. So anyway, it was you know, it was a real emergency and a real disaster in every sense. And it took, you know, basically that day to get the rest, to get the injured down and get medical treatment for them and to try to recover bodies. And then as a team, we actually all sat to decide whether we wanted to continue with the expedition or whether we were going to call it off at that point. But we talked to the Sherpas, and you know, kind of where we left it was we left it up to them as to whether they wanted to continue or whether they didn't, because these were literally their family members who had been killed.
Yeah.
And what we told them is that we would pay their full wages and all that, even if they wanted to call off the expedition. We were totally fine with that happening, and they. They really decided that they wanted to continue on with the expedition as well, and so we did that. We continued on, but it was a very eye-opening, very illuminating, very difficult.
The Khumbu icefall is the most dangerous part of the trip, at least when you're climbing Everest via the route that both Kim and Doug took. You have to pass through it more than once, maybe up to a dozen times. The Sherpas hauling supplies for climbers, they might make two or three times as many trips. In 2014, 16 Sherpas assigned to build the icefall route were killed in an avalanche. The rest of the climbing season via the south route up Everest was called off. Searing actually takes a different route and is able to avoid the Khumbu icefall. In recent seasons, he's climbed Everest from the north side, which has its own challenges, but at least avoids that one hurdle. For those who do pass through it, it can be a scary, surreal experience.
Yeah, it really is. It really is hard to picture, and you don't even when you see the pictures of the icefall, you really don't get a good sense of the scale of it. But it's, imagine an ice cliff that's about 2,000 feet in elevation gain over a relatively short lateral stretch of what I don't know, half a mile maybe or so, maybe not even that much, and so it's steep. And you're climbing up and around these, you have to use ladders to climb over these crevasses that could be 100 feet, 150 feet deep. And meanwhile, you have these large ice cliffs called seracs, which tower overhead and can come tumbling down. And while you're in the ice fall, you hear the ice creaking and groaning and cracking, and there'll be small avalanches as the ice collapses in places. It's a treacherous, dangerous, dangerous place. And there's no real safe way to get through it. What you try to do is get through it as quickly as you possibly can from bottom to top. And you don't just climb through the ice fall once on an expedition, you climb through it multiple times as you acclimatize and as you take loads up higher and come back down. So you may pass through the ice fall 10 times on an expedition. Always a very, very, very treacherous place, very scary place.
Yeah.
There's sections that may be flat where you're just walking across, and there's sections where you're actually climbing ladders, going vertical. To get up and over a serac. And there's some areas where you're just having to grind up, on your front points of your crampons, although on a fixed line, just climbing up. So it's a relatively steep climb that you're making.
Yeah.
To get through the ice fall.
Somewhat demanding, it seems like.
No, very demanding.
Yeah,
very demanding, yeah. And you're also, remember, you're starting at 17,000 feet, right. So you're already at an oxygen deficit to begin with. So for me, the way that I would get through the ice fall is I would push myself so that I was on the edge of vomiting. If I was pushing myself physically that hard, I know I was climbing as hard as I could possibly go to get through there. But you adapt over time. And I think the first time I went through the ice fall, I think it took me something like 2 hours to get from bottom to the top of the ice fall. But the last time I climbed through it, I was able to do it in about 30 minutes.
Kim found the experience interesting as well.
Going into it, I thought I'd be scared, because I did have apprehension about that. But then you get in there, and it's kind of like a video game, and it feels so cool, and it's majestic and glorious and terrifying all at the same time. But I was just having so much fun that fear, I don't think, ever really crept in.
Fun? What was fun about it?
just you read about something, you dream about something, and then you're there, and it's just the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. You just can't even fathom how they find a route and the ice and the size of everything and the colors and it's cool.
I asked Doug to give us a guided tour up the rest of the mountain from the top of the ice fall.
So when you get to the top of the ice fall, Camp 1 is at the head of it, but Camp 1 is really threatened by any avalanches that come off the west shoulder of Everest. So you don't want to spend a lot of time in Camp 1 because it's a dangerous place itself. Yeah. From Camp 1 at about 19,000 feet, you climb up to Camp 2, which is about 19,000 feet. Camp 2 is about 21,000 feet. Okay. Excuse me. Camp 1's at 19. Camp 2's at 21,000 feet, and that's really advanced base camp.
Yeah.
And it's a relatively protected area, so not threatened by avalanches. And it's kind of the highest area where you can really recuperate, heal, relax, because you're still relatively low on the mountain at that point. And then from Camp 2, you start a steep climb up what's called the Lhotse Face.
Okay.
Up Camp 3 is about halfway up the Lhotse Face, a very treacherous area just because it's on a steep cliff. And then from Camp 3, you get up to High Camp, which is up at about 26,000 feet. And then, you know, at that point, your next stop is the summit.
What's the view? What's it like at Camp 4 there, the High Camp?
So Camp 4 is you're 26,000 feet, and it feels it. It feels different. You feel like you're high up on the mountain.
Even compared to 23 or 24.
Even compared, it feels like you're in an alien space up at High Camp. I thought it was just get a sense that you're really high up on a mountain, but it's up there. It's pretty flat, a broad-shouldered pass really that you're standing on top of, and so good place to set up your highest camps to attack the high mountain. But it's by that time, if your team is using supplemental oxygen, you're on oxygen at that point.
Yeah.
And you're so high that you don't spend a lot of time walking around or engaging in extraneous activity just because it's so difficult to breathe and to get oxygen in. But from there, our weather was spectacular, and so we had a great view of the climb up to the area called the Balcony, and up to the Hillary Step, and then up to the summit itself. So, pretty remarkable place.
So you wake up, two in the morning or something?
Well, we climbed from Camp 3 to Camp 4, got to Camp 4 at, I don't know, like maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then rested that afternoon, and then got up at about 9 p.m. to start our summit climb. Yep. And took about an hour or so just to get ready to climb. And so we were actually climbing toward the summit at 10:30 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Roughly. And all with an idea of being on the summit, early in the morning as the sun is coming up, so that we could get up there while the weather was still good, still predictably good, and get back down and make it back down into High Camp, well before the standard 2 p.m. cutoff, a turnaround time, which is when you want to be off the summit because that's when the storms tend to move in. So we kicked off and climbed all the way through the night and hit the Hillary Step, which is one of the last real obstacles before the summit, right as the sun was coming up, around 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, and made it up to the summit as the sun was really rising, and just to an absolutely gorgeous morning, beautiful day. So once you get above the Hillary Step and you have those last, you know, few hundred meters to the summit, it's a, you've really climbed the most difficult, all the most difficult sections. So it's a, you're climbing a slope and you're right at the very, you're on a ridge, a sharp ridge, that.
Like tip over and you're going to. Like
if you're a tip over, so as you're climbing up, you're a tip over to the right side, you're kind of falling off on the north side of the mountain, you know, your next stop is, what, 10,000, 12,000 feet down? Same on the left side. I mean, there's no stopping. So
it's not exactly safe.
So you don't want to fall. You don't want to fall. But it's not hard climbing. You just don't want to fall. But it's you're on a side hill, on a side slope, a snow slope leading up to that ridge, and you're kind of climbing on the crest of the ridge, making sure not to get too close to the right edge because you could be on a cornice, and were the cornice to go, then you would go to.
Yeah.
And then it climbs all the way up to the summit, and the summit itself is, you know, it's small. It's like, I don't know, 5 feet by 5 feet, like a little tabletop where you have three ridges coming together.
Yeah.
So it's not big. It's not very dramatic, actually. Yeah. It's not dramatic like some true summits are. It just kind of flattens out, and you have a little flat area there. And you can, but at that point, it's obviously the summit. You're at the highest point around. So you can look into Tibet, down into Nepal. You know, you can look, you can see everything. It's pretty amazing. And there's lots of prayer flags, and people leave photos as mementos and things like that. You know, honestly, it's a little bit littered.
Yeah.
Because of all that type of stuff.
What's it like taking, like, getting to the top there?
It's it's intense. You know, my emotions are certainly heightened by the physical exhaustion and the mental exhaustion of getting up there. And on the one hand, it's exhilarating. On the other hand, it is, you know, that you are way, way out on a limb. It's a dangerous place to be. And so always in the back of your mind is getting down safely and sort of that trepidation of having enough stores and enough energy to make it back down. So it's exhausting, it's exhilarating, it's scary.
You know? Is it windy?
You know, when I was on the top, it was beautiful. It was, maybe 0 degrees, no wind. So I had my down suit unzipped. I just had glove liners on. It was a perfectly pleasant. You couldn't have even flown a kite off the top because there was no wind. I mean, there was nothing. It was just gorgeous.
Yeah.
So we were really fortunate. You know, for other people, they may make the summit. It can be a complete whiteout in stormy, cloudy conditions, and you know they don't get the view.
have any scary moments personally where you were? You mentioned a couple avalanches and the ice fall came kind of close to you.
Yeah, probably the scariest, sort of objectively, the scariest portion of the climb was actually on the summit and the summit push. Some of the teams that were supposed to set the fixed lines high up, up above the balcony and the south summit, didn't do it. For whatever reason, which I've never learned. So we were climbing large sections with no ropes, and just having to, you know, climb it. And so where normally there might be a fixed line in case you did fall, here we had nothing. So, you know, I was talking about the last sections through the summit and all that. You just had to make sure not to fall.
There's usually a rope through there.
So there typically is a rope all the way up through the Hillary Step and then beyond there may be ropes. Here we had no ropes from the balcony on.
If you were one of the last groups to climb it in that season, how had there not been groups before you?
That's a good question. Who knows?
Yeah.
who knows? Sometimes things just don't happen like you expect that they will have. And so when we were climbing, it was still dark out before the sun had come up, before hitting the Hillary Step, climbing some fairly steep terrain with no ropes, was a little heightened the senses.
Yeah.
And then when I climbed the Hillary Step itself, there was some old line, some old tat that was down in the Hillary Step, but not stuff that was, you know, particularly trustworthy. So I ended up just climbing the Hillary Step. I just climbed.
What is the Hillary Step look like?
So the Hillary Step, it's a cliff. It's a rock cliff. You know, about, I don't know, maybe 30 feet tall or so, depending on where you climb, maybe as tall as 50 feet.
Just straight, but 90 degrees straight down?
No, if you were climbing it down here, it would be, a, I don't know, a 5.0 to, you know, 5.3 rock climb. So very sort of easy, moderate rock climb.
Yeah.
Made more difficult just by the altitude and all the stuff that you have on. But kind of fun. I mean, it was kind of fun climbing to think that you're up there rock climbing on the top of Mount Everest. It was kind of neat.
Okay, to be honest, I kind of get it. That sounds absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible. Let's go back to Kim to wrap up the story with the avalanche. Here's how he left her, at Camp 2, with avalanches raining down from high on Mount Everest.
You could just hear just a rumble in kind of this amphitheater that we were sitting in. And the ground stopped shaking, but the noise was just somewhat terrifying because you didn't know where it was coming from. So now we knew that there were avalanches, but we couldn't see anything. So where we were sitting, almost 360 degrees of just thousands and thousands of feet up of stuff that can fall and crumble and just crush you. And we didn't know where it was coming from. So the problem with not knowing where an avalanche is coming from is you don't know where to hide. So if you can see an avalanche coming towards you can, you know, get behind a rock or some sort of structure. But when you don't know, you're just kind of sitting duck. So one avalanche came off the western shoulder of Everest and stopped in a crevasse. And then another one came off of another 8,000 meter peak called Nupsi.
Yeah.
And then the biggest one, I think, came down the face of Lhotse. And that's where the route goes up to Camp 3 and further up. And we got blasted with what I thought was a very large powder cloud. Apparently it was pretty minor, but enough to cover us in snow. And then it just settled.
This is all, like, what's the span of time on this?
This is all in the course of 2 minutes.
Oh,
from the moment the ground shook, maybe less. I think the earthquake was maybe, it was well over a minute, maybe a minute and 45 seconds.
Huh.
Yeah, it was a long time. And then when the ground finally stopped shaking and the avalanches stopped, we all just kind of sat there thinking, what the hell was that?
Those at base camp hadn't been so lucky. An avalanche had destroyed much of the camp and killed 19 there. Kim was safe, but her ordeal was just beginning. The earthquake destroyed the climbing route through the icefall, meaning all the climbers stranded above it had to wait 3 days to be rescued by a helicopter. Then after that, her team spent the next several weeks making its way back to Kathmandu. They stopped along the way to help start the rebuilding process at some of the homes owned by their Sherpa guides. And really, Kim's ordeal still isn't over. Despite what happened, she's right back there now, hoping to reach the summit of Mount Everest this spring.
Do you feel lucky you weren't in base camp?
Yeah, I feel lucky across the board. I mean, base camp's supposed to be the safest place on the mountain. And it wasn't. And I think arguably Camp 2 or Camp 1 is one of the most dangerous places on the mountain to be, to withstand an earthquake and multiple avalanches. And, you know, I think with time and reflection, I asked myself, you know, how the hell did we get out of that one alive? And then base camp just got annihilated.
Yeah.
And at some point you have to stop asking why and just be grateful that you're still here and you get a chance to do it again.
Was there ever any, I mean, considering how nature can just take the safest place in the mountain and make that happen, was there ever any doubt in your mind you'd go back?
No.
No.
And I don't know why. I mean, I think I even said at Camp 2, if this is it, I'm sure I had some choice words, but I said, if this is it, I'll see you assholes next year, right back here to do it again.
Yeah.
And a lot of people struggled and, you know, didn't want to come back, and a lot of people aren't coming back. some have just now decided to come back, but I think I just knew in my mind that this is my time to go, and if I don't do it now, I don't know that I'll want to come back, so.
Are you afraid of something like that happening?
No. I mean, you can't be.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a risk that you know going into a trip like this, or really any trip in the mountains or the backcountry, there are certain risks that you have to be willing to accept and know that you do everything in your power to control what you can, and what you can't, you just kind of give up to God to, you know, if it's my time, it's my time. I'd rather die doing something that I love than, you know, die of a heart attack sitting at a desk.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to take the gamble.
So, that's all we got. For more on this Mount Everest story, please check out the Steamboat Pilot and Today newspaper or www.steamboattoday.com. For any feedback, please shoot me an email at jrichenberger@steamboattoday.com. That's jrichenberger at steamboattoday.com. I want to send out a big thank you to everyone who helped with this project and to bensound.com for the music. Thanks for listening.